back here playing the drums as though he was being paid for it. Dr. Roboto himself, Mark Rosicky.
Okay, everyone, we are back with episode 32 of The Great Divide. We're coming fresh off the last interview with Bruce Watson, and Svein and I were ready to go into just one of our, I guess, quote-unquote, more mundane shows where we discuss something, and then something great happened. An interview with the great Mark Rosicky came upon our doorstep, and so we are welcoming Mark to the show for the first time. How you doing, Mark?
I'm very well. Nice to talk to you, Tom.
You too.
And you, Svein?
Yes.
And you, John. Oh, sorry, I'm not supposed to give that away.
That's okay. John is lurking in the shadows, yeah. As most people know. And and with me, as always, is Svein from Norway. How are you doing, Svein?
I'm pretty good. Looking forward to this. So We were ready for talking about something completely different, but I guess for 2 days now, we knew that it would be Mark instead. So we'll see how quickly we can get reorganized. Good to have you here, Mark.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Definitely. Okay, so Mark, I guess the best place to start, and as I say, this will just be like a free-flowing type of conversation with some minimal structure, I guess, but I think the best way to start is where you guys are now. I mean, can you talk to us a little bit about the whole situation with Simon coming on board and your feelings toward that? And I know you've only played a few shows, but what's your general feeling of the way the band stands at the moment with Simon?
We're very happy the way things are. Big Country's always been the future of Big Country's always been uncertain. It's always been a fragile thing. I mean, I know I haven't quoted a lyric there, but Big Country's always been very fragile under the surface of his toughness and the robust sound and the thundering marching drums and the rousing guitars. It's underneath, it's always been a whole flow of different things happening underneath, which causes things to be, behind the scenes, always very delicate. You know, it's like any relationship. Things shift and move around, and recovering from the loss of Stuart, wasn't easy. And Mike played a great role in that, coming back in, reviving the band. Obviously, yeah. It took all of us, including Tony at that time, to get involved. We needed that time to pass, to reflect and to feel what was the right thing to do. But, Mike came in and did a fabulous job. Obviously, when Mike came in, we knew... I mean, everyone's very individual in this band. So everyone, as much as we're seen as one unity, behind the scenes, everyone has different opinions, like anything. And Mike really... brought a lot of spirit of what Big Country's flavour was, and particularly in the way he respected Stuart's past and looked to that a lot to inspire himself for the future with us.
Right.
But we always knew that Mike came with the fact that he was from another band. His being with us was magnificent, but we all always knew at some point he would have to go and do what he has to do with his own band. He wasn't just a member of Big Country, and getting through that was for me it was something that I saw an inevitability. But other band members found individually they had different feelings over what happened, but for me I could see that Mike, he reignited the band, because we needed the front man, the guy who had the voice, who could deliver, take on, be the guy at the front leading the helm, like Stuart always did. We had the guitar sorted out between Bruce and Jamie, but we didn't have that lead vocal and that guy driving the band. And we had our own mini Bono, to be honest with you, with Mike.
Yep.
And very much people said that back to us. But, when the American tour finished and it was a fabulous tour for me. I enjoyed it. I love being out in America. I had a really great time. But financially, the last month, it didn't do the band any good, because we had like 3 months worth of shows and 3 months touring out here and only 2 months really worth of gigs. So last month really caused problems within the band financially, and it made us stand back and look at everything. And at the same time, Mike had been planning to go out to, you know, I don't know, he's all around the world, you know, Mike, with his love and strength. He's a very, very, very busy guy, and he's very motivated for his charity and for his music, and I really admire and respect Mike for that. So I knew at some point there'd be a parting of ways, but all that we didn't realise was it would be, you know, pretty much Mike needed to take almost a year out, and that, you know, I could cope with that because I always have other places I can fall back into. I can revive or make phone calls and get, not always, but within reason, I can keep myself alive as a drummer. What if Bruce, you know, as what was happened when Stuart passed, you know, Bruce went back into Sim Street and went back to his dockyard job, which was very hard to see Bruce do that. And of course, we didn't want to see any of that happening again. So with all the momentum that we made in America, which we did make steps forward, as well as keeping the band together and experiencing playing the journey live, which was fabulous, and meeting all you guys out there again, you know, we needed to really keep that alive and still keep the engine oiled and moving forward. So it was better that Mike went and did what he did.
Yeah, definitely. And I think when you talk about feeling that it was inevitable, I think some of the fans probably felt that way too. I know that I sort of had that feeling when he first joined, you know.
Well, how Bruce described it, and it really sums it up, to be honest, was, you know, we can't get Stuart back. There are bands that have got their lead singers that are still alive, you know, from The Jam with Paul Weller, you know, from Fish with Marillion, and the list goes on. There are people where the singers move out of the band, but they're still on the planet. But Stuart, unfortunately, left the planet, so we can't ask him back. So right. To be able to carry on, we have to have the vocal in place. And to be honest, and this isn't trivializing anything, this is actually sort of put in his pocket. Bruce, it doesn't really matter who it is, as long as they're great and they can perform the songs with the right spirit and attitude, because they are the new Doctor Who. That's what Bruce called it.
That's great.
Because it's still the Doctor. You know, it's never going to be Stuart, so it's going to be somebody, and right. They are the new Doctor Who. And in a way, I kind of saw Bruce meant when he said, first of all, you know, it kind of came along by, not by accident. We were rehearsing up in Clitheroe because we have new agent in Pete Barton from Rock Artist Management, and he does more than just be the agent. He does, you know, more like day to day running of a band. He's a musician himself. He sings lead vocals for the Animals. He's a very talented guy. He's got a fabulous voice in a different style to Big Country, of course, in a bluesy way. And he plays great bass. But because he's a musician as well as a businessman, he was able to really look at the band and say, well, look, guys, you are in a little bit of a position here. Mike's had to go and do what he's got to do. We all respect that. And we wish him well. And I'm still really great mates with Mike. You know, I really do wish him well. He just said, look, with all the people that I know, because I have a big roster of people that I manage, and I've got an infrastructure of different bands and people that are in and out of different bands, I've got a lot of people here that we can call upon. And one guy I think you should try out for sure is Simon Howe. Simon Howe, he's a real nice guy. See what you think. It was pretty much that. We were rehearsing ourselves while we were, you know, scratching our heads as to how we move forward. And Simon came down, and he was amazing. He'd done a little bit of homework through Pete giving him a heads up to learn two or three songs. And he came in and he sounded remarkably like Stuart. I must admit, not deliberately, but the fact that he's a proper vocalist. I mean, he's done stuff. He's got a good background. And he's a nice guy. He's more of our age group. And Bruce, first of all, was like, he went, he's amazing. But then Bruce suddenly had cold feet and said to me, I'm not sure about Simon. And I said, why is that? He said, he's too good.
That's what he told us. He said he sounded too good.
He said he's too good. And I said, well, what do you mean? Because now I'm from a slightly different playing field to Bruce, because I came up through the kind of musician side of things more so than Bruce, where he was more into the punk thing and grabbing guitar and making his own sound. As much as I've got my own sound, I'm in and out of playing with different more musicians than anyone in the rest of the band. perhaps than say than Derek. So for me, it was just I could see his potential, because to me it didn't matter that he was too good. I mean, too good didn't mean anything to me. He was good enough. That's, I saw it from that level rather than looking from above and coming down. It was already good enough, you know. And knowing that we can't replace Stuart, as long as when I shut my eyes and I'm playing the songs, because I tend to get in my own little space when I play, I often shut my eyes when I play. And I just thought, well, hang on a minute, what I'm hearing here is different to Mike, because Mike didn't sound like Stuart, which some people say is a great thing. Mike had his own voice and a wonderful voice that he has, but he brought his own thing to Big Country, which people loved. Some people didn't think he sounded like Stuart, but then it wasn't the aim to. It was always the aim to represent the songs. And coincidentally, I just thought Simon actually has an early Stuart Adamson voice, where Stuart's voice changed over the years when he, you know, as people often said, he sounded a bit more Americanized when he moved over here. And you know, he was very into, you know, articulating himself slightly different when he was singing in the latter days. I think that was his American influence over here with Marcus, with the teamed up with Marcus and having the Nashville influence. But to when we first started with Big Country, Stuart's voice, he always said he was never a singer, and he always found it quite awkward to do the transition from being the guitarist in the Skids, where Richard Jobson was the front man, and he suddenly was, you know, the front man, singer, vocal, guitarist, singer, songwriter. You know, he had everything to do. So he always found it a little bit hard to, he wasn't confident in his own voice, to the point where when we were having producers in the early days, from Chris Thomas to Steve Lillywhite, they really did encourage Stuart to really embrace what he actually had naturally. I know both producers had, you know, when Stuart was like almost, because he was a very shy guy, Stuart, as well, you know, as much as he had the front on stage, he was, you know, he wanted to do well. He was proud in what he did. He wanted to be the best. And by being like that, he wanted to question whether everything was okay. And in the early days, he wasn't confident with his own voice, but everyone else was saying, it's fabulous because it's unique, it's you, and it's you know, you've got your own trademark sound in your vocal. But as he'd never really been that front man, he needed that encouragement, which the producer, particularly Steve Lillywhite, gave Stuart. And in the early stuff, you know, the really early stuff, his voice was far more coming from the Skids and undeveloped as it was, in a way, to where he honed his voice over years of singing lead vocals and being the singer of the Big Country. But those early stuff on the Crossing, Close Action, and you know, those that kind of era, All of Us, Simon kind of got that timbre in his voice, which is a complete coincidence. I mean, he sings like that anyway. And after the first or second show, you know, there was a few things saying, you know, he sounds remarkably a lot like Stuart's early voice. Not that he sounds like him, he sounds like Simon to me. But he does bring that flavour, the tonal quality to the band, that we haven't had since Stuart's gone. We'll be right back. Made me and Bruce sit down and say, how should we move forward with the way we present the songs? And what we decided to do was perhaps go the other way to what Mike bought, because Mike bought, the unique thing that Mike bought was that he had a strong sense of being ad lib. He'd be out in the audience, he'd be climbing things, he was like the Bono of the band, and he would break down the songs, and he would he had this whole Bruce Springsteen thing that he loved, where he could cue the band to come back in, making it more theatrical.
Right. He was definitely a showman.
Yeah, very much a showman of that kind of school, the Bruce Springsteen and the Bono, and very much Mike Peters. And he loved Big Country for being able to do that. And we embraced that. We had lots of breakdown sections, and, the ad-lib stuff was all over the shop, where sometimes we didn't even know where we were when Mike was coming back in. We didn't have to sort of second guess each other.
Right.
But what me and Bruce sat down and said, look, it's sounding fabulous with Simon. It's reminding us of the early days. So why don't we just take the songs back to the way they really were when we recorded them? So we've looked at the arrangements, and we've gone all the breakdown sections, we're going to play them like the record, because they stand up as a song.
Nice.
And it's getting back more to our roots, rediscovering where we came from, more so in the way we were arranging them. We dropped a lot of the the extended middles out, and we're now playing them pretty much like they were recorded, even to the point where we look at the early demos to see how we recorded the demos in the form of arrangement to make them more like playing a record live.
Oh, really? Interesting.
It made it interesting because I had to sort of de-learn. The ad-libs became so common. You know, even Stuart used to live in certain areas. 35 years of playing it in a certain way, and only playing it once in the original way, you know, the 35 years was the blueprint, but the original way, it kind of slipped away, you know. So we've gone back to the blueprint on a lot of the songs, and it's not only made it easier for Simon to learn the stuff because of the fact that we can just say, look, here's the demo of it, learn it that way, or here's another version, let's do it that way. You know, we're all on the same page very quickly, and it's refreshing for the band after playing these songs for so long to actually play them authentically, you know, because Simon brought that authenticity back. Less theatrical, but more authentic is perhaps I can say.
Oh, that's a great way to describe it, I think.
Yeah, so we're very happy with the way things are going. It's still early days with Simon, nothing to do with saying that in regards to Simon, in the fact that what we're going to do as a band, because, you know, I'd like to do a new album. And there are little ideas that we always do, like Big Country always do. We always rehearse ideas at sound checks. You know, Jamie's got some great ideas being a young guy. And Bruce has got stuff bubbling over. I've got ideas, and Derek brings stuff into it as well. So we're always jamming little ideas and saying, that'll make a great song and blah, blah, blah. Keep that in the, you know, we call it the think tank, to do a collection of new ideas. That we were always like that with Stuart as well, with Tony. We always constantly throwing stuff in to the mix at sound checks, or even when, you know, backstage before we play, someone would come up with an idea. And we retain those ideas and run them up the flagpole once in a while to see if we still, A, can remember them, and B, is anything we can add to them. And they normally turn out to be fabulous ideas. So that's still happening within the band. And I think right now the focus is pretty much stabilizing the band so that, you know, people accept Simon. Simon's confident in what he's doing. You know, he had loads of lyrics on the stage. Obviously, because the words, you know, Simon said, the word to Stuart was a poet. And some of the words... it's not easy to remember, and I've got to say, because I do play in other bands over the years, and I play other music with different genres, and Big Country is which I'm very proud of, is very, very unique, and it's unique in the sense that the structures of the songs aren't typical of what normal, if there is such a thing these days, I don't know what's normal anymore, but the structures of Big Country songs are unpredictable in the way that they unfolded. You know, they almost look like that they've been cut and pasted together, which in a funny way, back in the day they were, because when we were recording in the early days, when we were recording to tape, we know we used to put stuff down and write different sections out and put them on the floor and pick the pieces up and say, well, that'll go there, you know, almost like a random jigsaw puzzle. and Stuart's did that with some of his lyrics as well. He used to write certain lyrics down on pieces of paper, mix them up and see what came out of the bag and see if he could get inspired by the randomness of the words that would come out differently to what he thought, you know.
Well, I think that worked for you.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't done all the time, but it was something that only in hindsight, particularly when somebody like Simon's come in to learn these songs, he found some of them easy because they were the hits that he may have known, but the more the stuff that he may not have heard, like All of Us and some of the
Restless Natives, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, the arrangements weren't stereotypical, so he had to really physically learn them. It wasn't instinctive, if you know what I mean. And I can understand why, because the band grew out of not being a traditional 12-bar bluesy band. You know, it didn't have intro, verse, chorus, middle, eight, outro. Although some of them did, they had sections. You know, they had a moody section or a lifting section or a thematic section or a drum section. They had different parts that were kind of bolted together. Different songs were often bolted together. So first few shows, Simon's had a ton of lyrics all out on stage, and, you know, highlighted in highlight pen on the floor. And I remember the other show, a few shows back, the support band had taken all his notes out and put him in a little pile on the side of the stage. To his horror, he laid them all out in a special order. And we were supposed to go straight on the stage. So, but he's now got a little iPad, because I know Mike had the same thing. He had a big Mike Peters used to have a big visual monitor, at the front, where he could cue all the lyrics. But now it's all got small. Simon's got a little iPad on a mic stand, just to not for all the songs now, because he's starting to learn them, but just so he's got that confidence in front of him. So it's still early days, and he's really getting it together, and we're really happy with things. I know I'm offing here, but once I get on a thread, I tend to go off on. Are you like the blue touch paper? And I go,
hey, I love it. This is great. I'm just sitting here, you know, listening and taking this all in. It's because we don't get a lot of that information, especially here in America and in Norway, where Svein is. So it's nice to hear a little of the inside, how it's developing.
Well, right now, to kind of get the band going, we're a kind of, the focus of the band shifted from, I mean, the whole music industry has changed, as being a musician yourself, as you know. It's all downloads, you don't have the big record deal anymore. When we were signed for, five album deal, you don't get those anymore.
Yep.
So we've got to kind of make our own route, and a lot of it's survival. It's a tough world out there, and we're a band that's had tragedies and highs and lows, and had to survive those changes. And the music still stands up; people still want to hear the songs, and we all co-wrote those songs, and we love playing them. And I know there's a whole world out there of people that love to hear our music, as you tell us, So we love playing the songs. But right now we're in this period of kind of getting this, without using the word the journey, we're kind of starting a journey again, because since Mike moved on to doing The Alarm and doing his own thing, we've had to kind of regroup and start again. And right now it's kind of the nuts and bolts, the hard work of the band is we're a working band most weekends now. And that wasn't how Big Country used to be. Big Country used to have different seasons in the old way of, you would have a season of writing, demoing, maybe having a release with a little flavour of what's to come with the album that's still being written and recorded. Then you have your 6 weeks tour, then you have time off to be at home, and then you have more writing periods. But this time it's kind of pretty much taken our body of work and getting everyone into the machine process of actually becoming a really great sounding band again by touring, and touring each weekend, which is kind of what we're doing. But personally, for me, I want to see the new ideas that are there. I don't want to lose the aspect of having a new album. I know Bruce at the moment is very much like, well, let's get ourselves steady before we move on into those areas. But for me, I already feel we're pretty steady, because Simon's doing such a great job, and he's learning very fast and bringing his own flavor to it as well. That
I tell you what, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Bruce has been very active on a Facebook page called the Big Country Guitar Group, and it's where guitarists talk about their craft. But Bruce has posted some clips of him playing along with Jamie some new music that they've written and been working on, and it sounds great. I mean, a lot of it harkens back to the Restless Natives. Yeah, so
I see one. Yeah, they sound. Bruce has always got great ideas. He's, as much as Stuart brought a massive amount to the band, it's undeniable. There was a lot of stuff that Bruce bought as well. And often in the early days, Bruce was quite unsung because the focus was a lot on Stuart. And that's not taking anything away, but it's more saying that Bruce, is to be credited for a lot more than people actually realized, with the sound and some of the flavors that you get, and a lot of the attitude in the guitar playing also was embellished by Bruce. But he's got great ideas, Bruce, and he still has that sound, he has the guitar sound with Jamie, without a doubt. It's absolutely phenomenal. And yeah, I did actually only last week, I think I found it by accident. I thought, Bruce doing here playing the guitar? What's he doing? And I thought, that's a nice idea. Bruce tends to have great ideas, and I always felt within the band, particularly with the combination with Stuart, both of them had great ideas, but it was the sum of the band that brought the ideas into songs, because again, they don't write in a traditional way. They I know writers that will write a song from start to finish in a traditional way.
Right.
Whereas if Bruce writes with a kind of a feel, he writes with, he'll get a great section or a great sound. He's inspired by a sound, you know, and he'll repeat that sound with a few basic chords, and then you've got the bones of a really good song, an idea. But it needs often I find when he brings it into the band, it turns it from being an idea into a song more so, particularly once lyrics are involved. But Bruce writes in a unique way, which I love, and it always gives me room, because I always like to get involved in the arrangement as well as the music, because I play a bit of piano myself, not in a great way, but I'm good at it.
I was going to say, he mentioned that, and I think people were a little surprised to hear that, and that you that you play the keyboard and play piano, and he told us that you contributed a lot to that, to the writing.
Well, I really don't just like being the drummer, although that is my role, because the fact that music moves me. The only reason I play the drums is because I'm playing music. I've always been from a musical side of playing the drums. You know, I as much as I can do solos and do that stuff, you know, there's clinicians out there that tour and do that stuff for all the drum companies, and they're phenomenal. But I'm actually a song drummer. I play songs. It's playing music the reason I picked up playing the drums wasn't to be a drummer per se, to go out and do solos and, you know, to be a clinician, although now and again you got to do that if you get asked to do that by your sponsors. I'm actually a song drummer, and I love the fact that I've got loads of music in my head, and obviously from a different source, where Bruce and Stuart went through the sort of more punk thing, I came up through, funny enough, all the American style of music. You know, anything that didn't have lyrics on, I was really into, because the drumming was more prominent, you know, in the early days of Billy Cobham and Return to Forever, Herbie Hancock, Chick Corea, all that stuff that, you know, Steely Dan, although Steely Dan had great vocals in there. But the muso side of stuff, I always was really inspired, because nobody had heard that stuff really in the UK in the early 80s, late 70s, other than musos. And being, you know, in a band that was a young and creative band, I wanted to tap into some of the great drum style things you could get, the more detail that was involved in drumming, rather than what was happening in the UK. But alongside of that, I always wanted to bring my musical side in, where, you know, I would suggest how a chord may need to change, or, you know, a key change, or even suggesting notes, or even get my keyboard out and playing a whole section, which is what I did often. To bring a new piece into the song, a middle eight, or, you know, I really love music. So I often sat frustrated watching the guys, you know, whilst we're all in a room together, drumming the guitars, and I think, why don't they go to that chord? And they're going, what chord is it, Mark? And I say, I can't sing you a chord, I've only got one note. If I had a keyboard here, I could break down the notes, because I understand all that stuff. I do know music.
Right.
And so in the end, I just brought my keyboard down, and then, you know, I could say, right, Tony, this is your root note. Stay there. Bruce, go to this chord, but I don't know what it is, but here it comes. These notes. And he would sort of go, well, you know, that's not playable on the guitar. I said, well, try and make it sound like it. You know, just go there now. And then he'd come out with his own version of it normally. And it would always sound better, because it sounded like Big Country again. But I still do like to contribute in my own way. One song came directly from my keyboard that I'd written in 1991, actually. Hurt was a song that I'd almost, not without the title, there's no lyrics, but the main theme of Hurt was from a keyboard thing I did, along with many other songs I've got on my keyboards. And Mike kind of came up with the chorus. Yeah, I do love it contributing musically, and we're still going to be doing that as we did on the journey, you know, when I took my keyboards in. I think it's really important, and it's something I've always done in the band. I mean, I have told this story before, but I remember years ago we were sitting by the piano, and I don't know what studio it was. I was in a studio somewhere, because we were in so many studios, whether it be in Scotland or in London or in a demo studio or a master studio, and Stuart was at the piano. And me and Stuart used to try and play the piano together. I'd sit on one end of the stool, he'd sit on the other. And we'd just play one finger stuff, and he'd come up with a little riff on the piano with one finger. And I'd come out with a counter melody on the other side, be it higher up or lower down. And I said to him, why don't we do something where we don't hit any white notes? Just let's stay on all the black notes, because it always sounds a little bit, I'll probably come at the wrong explanation here, Chinese or...
Like a chopsticks, you know, type song. Yeah,
yeah, chopstick, completely, exactly. I mean, it's that basic. And that's where chance kind of came from. There was already the bones of chance through Bruce and Stuart. And I went onto the keyboards, and it kind of, we ended up playing a little bit of chance, and as was already there. And then I came up with the intro section, which was all on the black notes, bar one white note you have to hit, which most people have no idea that I was involved in that, which was that da 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 da. They're all on the black notes, bar one note, which if you play that, you'll see the one I mean. It's little things like that that, you know, I didn't make any noise about that, but I'm always involved in contributing in that in the whole thing, rather than and vocally, as you know, I like singing as well, rather than sitting playing the drums.
Yeah, and you've done great at that. And Svein, I know you want to. You got something to ask here.
Yeah, I just hearing you think about contributing musically, and that reminds me of something that Mike told us in an interview some episodes back, where he said he felt it was important that as much music as possible stemmed from Bruce and yourself, that this was the pure source of big country music, and he felt really strongly about that. Is that really the view of the band? When I listen to you, it seems like everybody's free to contribute, and you have a great think tank, and somehow it still sounds like big country by your involvement.
Well, it's nice you to say that. I mean, it's true. Everyone in Big Country, the great thing about coming into Big Country, because me and Tony came in when they were looking for a rhythm section, as you know, it was me and Tony, thankfully, and we're very proud of that, that when me and Tony got asked to come down to the studio, we you know, as you probably know, we were working with Pete Townsend, and it was the Right to Work march from Brockwell Park in Newcastle. They were walking down to reenact the march done in the 20s for the Right to Work. And they ended up in Brockwell Park in London, and Pete Townsend was headlining, and me and Tony had worked with Pete Townsend on the Empty Glass album. So we were playing in the Pete Townsend band live, and Ian Grant was in the audience with his band called The Members, as well as managing Stuart Adamson within the Skids.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, we were at the right place at the right time. We'd already done a tour, unbeknown to Ian, realizing who we were. We'd done a tour with the Skids with Simon Townsend, with On the Air, me and Tony and Simon, a year and a half before that. So we'd met Stuart anyway. And then when Ian approached us and said to Tony, you know, I've got this band that are looking for a rhythm section, and you know, you and Mark, you didn't know who I was actually, Ian, you two guys, you know, would you be interested in coming down and playing some songs down at the studio? We jumped at the chance. But of course, we'd already met Stuart, and it was the first time I met Bruce, and it just fell into place straight away. The chemistry was completely right. Everyone played amazingly together in those early demos. We knew we had a unique sound together. We're almost like the bumblebee. It shouldn't really work, because there's two Scotsmen with this really bizarre style, with these two musos from London that were into prog rock, you know.
Right.
We're like the bumblebee, and they bolted us together, and it's like, hang on a minute, it sort of works. You know, that you've just got this whole combination that works. So it's not something I never saw coming.
Do you remember, Mark? And I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, you cut me in. I'll keep talking.
I just was going to say that this is something I wanted to ask you about anyway, so I'm so glad that you're talking about it. I'm just very curious, because to a lot of us fans, that first meeting and that first time that you guys played together is kind of envisioned as this, you know, magical experience where you guys realize you had this chemistry. Do you remember exactly what you actually played the first time you ever played together, what song it was or what?
See, Bruce would be able to answer that.
Okay.
I could have a stab at it, and Bruce would go, that's complete fish, it was wrong. I can't really say what it was. I think it was, it may have even been, it could have been All of Us.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
It could have been that. It could have been something like, I remember them playing a demo to me, and the way the drum tracks were always done was that I think Bruce played the hi-hat and snare, and Stuart hit the floor toms and cymbals. But then there was something unique about that style where I heard this demo, I thought, what the hell's that on the drums? This is awful. And then I suddenly thought, I suddenly thought, hang on a minute, why don't I try and do my version of it? So where I would never have gone onto the floor, Tom, because it was like, I wouldn't have done that.
Right.
I thought, no, I'm going to go down that. They've obviously hit the floor, Tom, for a reason. That's part of the timbre of the song in their demo. I'm going to hit the floor, Tom. And it became almost my trademark in those Toms. You know? I was learning. I was very open to learning what made things sound different. And yeah. Bruce and Stuart both playing the drum kit, trying to make a drummer out of two people that couldn't play. I tried to create that in a more organized way on the drums, as well as feeling that, you know, it was a unique way of playing. It helped me develop my style by listening to how they couldn't play in a way, in a bizarre way.
That's so interesting. It's funny because I was reading in that book, A Certain Chemistry, before we spoke today, just to kind of brush up on some of the background. I don't know if you remember that book, but it was, mm-hmm. I think it came out in 86 or something.
And way too early.
yes. And you referred to it was funny how you referred to the Skids. You said you thought they were diabolical.
Well, I'll be candid here. When I was starting off drumming, my whole thing was, I mean, I've got to be honest, if you were to hear some of my early stuff with Tony Butler and Simon Townsend, we were like Rush as teenagers. We were so ahead of our time.
I've heard some of that, so we were
very together musically in a prog rock way, and of course, you know, prog rock went out the window when punk came in, and it swept away disco and prog rock, you know. But I still love prog rock for the fact the drums were always fabulous because they were drum orientated, different side time signatures. They were up in the mix. I liked them for a reason, you know. I could hear the drums, and they were very, very interesting. Some very complicated and very inspiring. So when punk came out, it's a hindsight thing for me. I think punk was a magnificent thing that happened. But when it first came out, I was horrified. It was like all that I'd aspired to be, like these amazing American drummers from Lenny White to Hurricane to Mike Clark to, you know, all my heroes, Billy Cobham, Steve Gadd, Harvey Mason, all these amazing American players nobody had heard of in the UK, especially my players I'd listened to. Mm. I aspired to be these people that, you know, but all of a sudden, all my trying to be great went out the window when I heard somebody just thrashing around the drum kit as if it was two guys playing the drums.
Right.
And it was. It was Bruce and Stuart. And, you know, and that was like the sound of what was happening. But having said that, there were some great players from that era as well. You know, I got to learn. It became part of what made me, you know, having to absorb that train crash of musicianship for me at that time.
Right. I think that's what made Big Country so special, too.
You
had those two different worlds colliding, and it was so beautiful.
When the Skids were playing, I've got to say, I didn't like the Skids on... I say I like the Skids. I liked Stuart's guitar playing, and I'm not saying that because he was in the band. I thought they had a great image. I was... I've got to say this. When punk broke, we went from a five-piece prog rock band with the Simon Townsend band to the band called On the Air, where we stripped it down to three-piece, and we went into a bit of a power pop punk band. We actually changed ourselves. So we, you know, going on the back of the Skids tour all that time, we were more in harmony musically than we would have been had we would never been on that Skids tour as a prog rock band. So we were already embracing what was around, and I did embrace the Skids. You know, Bruce said I thought it was diabolical. I don't think I ever said that. I just thought it wasn't the sort of band I want to be in at that time of my life, you know, because when I wanted to be in this other band, but, you know, I was very young then and very impressionable, and it was so different to what, you know, I'd ever heard. But I thought they were a great band to start off with. I mean, I thought the fact that the audience, you know, would go mad when they played, and I'd never seen anything like that. I thought Stuart had an incredible guitar style within the band. You know, I saw him at that point instantly from the side of the stage, because I went out the front with Tony many times to watch the Skids play, and me and Tony would stand there and look at Stuart and go, he's a guitar hero, he's one of those guys, he's a guitar hero in a band. You could see he had the whole thing. And, you know, he had that, like I would say about Pete Townsend, all the great guitars, Johnny Marr, you know, depending what era you go to, he had that. So I never thought they were rubbish. I just thought they were musically very different to what I could understand at that time.
Right.
I got involved in the band to the point where they suddenly said to us, just going back to where I was when we went down to the studio, they said, look, it's all sounding great. Everyone's really happy with everything. And the record company are really over the moon. It's all sounding good. And, you know, there's a record deal to sign. And I just went, record deal? I don't sign anything. I'm signing a record deal. I mean, stupid as it was at that time, because people give their right arm to do it now. I wasn't sure about it, is the truth.
Yeah.
I remember Tony jumping at, you know, saying this is the best thing that's happened and blah blah blah, and I'm going, well, are you sure? You know, I wasn't sure at that point what I would be allowed to do drum wise. I think that's probably where my head was at. I wasn't sure what the scope was for me at that point. Not that I just my head was back into a different style coming out of the prog thing. And you know, when the record deal came through the post and everyone had signed it and they were once again waiting for my signature, you know, I'm very shy at signing anything because I'm like, oh, what's it going to mean? Will I ever be able to play my drums again with anyone else? You know, will it cramp my style? Is this the right thing to do? Blah, blah, blah. You know, all the three things I shouldn't be saying as a late teenager. Yeah, I was in my early 20s. I didn't sign the record deal. I wanted to think about it. But at that time, I knew that I worked so great with Tony, and I had the whole empathy thing with Bruce and Stuart. I knew there was something quite magnificent happening. I did realize that. I was just really unsure whether, you know, I would be able to still play with anyone else, and you know, I wanted to be this big session man like the greats were from Steve Gadd to, you know, all the guys I loved in America at that time, and I didn't want to just suddenly limit myself but. Having said that, Tony and Bruce and Stuart signed this deal, and I just thought, what's wrong with myself? I've got to get involved in this. It's too good to let go. I knew there was something magical there. I must admit, I did feel that as well, but I was torn in between my sort of preserving the area that I wanted to move forward in, and not realizing that it would be actually this kind of music, you know. But very quickly, I was able to put my stamp on it, and also, to be honest with you, I was allowed to get away with a lot of things that a lot of drummers perhaps these days wouldn't be allowed to play as much as I got allowed to play, you know. I was able to express myself in a very unique way within Big Country, which gave me my own unique style and sound, I suppose.
Well, see, that's really interesting, because one other quote from the Certain Chemistry book from Pete Townsend that I always wanted to ask you about, so now I get my chance, and this is from 1986. Here's a quick quote from him about you, and he says, "My main fear hearing the first album was that Mark would not find enough scope for musical growth within Big Country. What is interesting is that Tony is perfectly fulfilled in the band. He has a new sound which works well with Bruce and Stuart and seems to thrive on Stardom. Mark, however, needs to be stretched. It would be a pity if he had to look constantly outside of Big Country for a challenge." So what do you think of that quote? And now, years on, I mean, do you feel like, and you just pretty much said that you were challenged in Big Country and did feel.
Well, I think that these were early days. I mean,
exactly.
It's an interesting quote. Knowing Pete Townsend as I do, I've recently been working with him.
I've been
in the studio. Yeah, I'm working with him at the moment. It's interesting because he is very much a guy to stretch you. I mean, he really. I think I can understand, because when you're talking about yourself, it's hard to stand back and talk about yourself. But I think you bring somebody else in the mix and see what they say about you. I think I can realize why he said that. And, you know, Tony really wanted to, in a way, I'm like, I didn't want to settle down and get married. Tony wanted to settle down and get married and have kids, with the band.
Yes,
and you know, he was happy for this to be his family and his baby. I was still like scratching around, going, you know, I still want to do my jazz fusion thing. I want to be one of these drummers. I want to be the prog drummer. I want to be this jazz. I want to be like one of these American greats, blah blah blah. But in Britain, and when I was working with Pete from the first, I mean, Tony was working with Pete at that time as well on the Empty Glass, and Tony's actually a very very complicated, busy bass player. Although he plays it in a simple way, he can play really simple, like he does, or very busy, like he's a lead guitarist within the band. So he's got a fabulous style, Tony, not unlike John Entwistle, where he can play very busy and powerful. But he can play very simple as well, Tony, you know, when he just has his chilled out way of playing the basic notes sometimes. And he can just hit those notes right, you know. And he, I, with Pete, when he Pete was quite intrigued by me, the fact that, I mean, bearing in mind, you know, he had Keith Moon, who would be Mr. Random on drums, you know. Keith wouldn't play the same twice. But what you got was, when you captured that moment that would be there forever, you had this most wonderful drum track that most drummers adore, his drumming, like I do, because they're almost a captured one-off at random, you know. And it had that spontaneity into it. And I tried to be a bit like that myself, where I would try and put out music, and I'd always say, oh, do you want me to do it again? Let me do another drum track. See if you like it like this. Let me see if you like it like that. Perhaps I could add this. Perhaps I could do that. You know, I never had, you know, I was always eager to throw in loads and loads of ideas. And in a way, I did that when I first worked with Pete. You know, I brought in different rotor toms and loads of different snare drums, and I would go through, you know, how I could play the song. And he would go with me and say, well, you know, why didn't you try and think differently in the beginning? Why didn't you? You know, he would challenge me a lot, Pete would. And, you know, we've gone full circle here, because not only did I have that chance to do that when Steve Lillywhite was recording with us. Steve really liked my drumming. I was very grateful that he did. And Steve would basically say to me, you know, that was great. Why didn't you try and think completely different? Why didn't you, the overdub that you wanted to do, why don't you see if you can play it in your drumming? See if you can add it into the drums. Why don't you see if you can, the bit you did when you were sitting playing on your own, you know, when you didn't realize we were listening, why don't you try and throw that in the middle? Like, you know, he would be very keen into hearing my detail. And it's the detail that he liked. You know, the devil's in the detail of my drumming, as far as Steve was concerned, as well as having that big sound. So a lot of big country stuff has got, for me, when I look back, has got a hell of a lot going on in every section, you know, where I'm allowed to really expand and try and put an original style into some drumming, you know, because drumming can be very mundane. It can be very much like anyone else. All the great drummers for me had, not only did they have their own drum sound, but they had their unique style at that time, from Keith Moon to John Bonham to Mitch Mitchell, you know, to Ginger Baker, you know, from the Brit stuff. They all had their own unique sound, their signature sound, and I always wanted that. And Steve Lillywhite gave me that because I had it there to give. You know, I had my own way of tuning, and there was a little bit of twist on my playing. But going back to Pete Townsend, you know, I'm really honoured that I'm chuffed that I've been working with him recently. Just before Christmas, I went in to do some songs for his new musical, his new rock opera called Floss.
Oh, that's incredible.
He's writing. It's been a long-going project with Pete. I've been on and off with a starting schedule, and it's been cancelled because he's either got busy with Tommy or the Who, or rewriting his narrative for the lyrics. You know, his the theme of these, the storyline changes slightly as time passes. So we eventually went into the studio, and this goes back to when I did an album with Pete Townsend called Psychoderelict, and that was a very experimental album with Pete. And again, Pete really enjoyed challenging me on that record, and it was not unlike going to do Floss this time around. He had lots of sequenced backing tracks, kind of like the Won't Get Fooled Again sequences that you get, the arpeggio stuff, with his trademark guitar. Pete's songwriting is constantly evolving at the time I went into the studio, and it's an interesting time to work with somebody when it's not quite defined. Because you're allowed to experiment. You know, do several takes with Pete where he would call me back into the studio, listen to what I've done, then sing a different lyric to me, and then the phrasings and the accents and the tone of the song would perhaps change, and he'd say, right, bear that in mind now, go and play it again, maybe stay off the ride cymbal or something. You know, he'd tell me to. He knows what he wants, but he's not sure how to get it. So he likes to sort of get you to bring it with him. And I enjoyed doing that with Pete immensely. And I think that's probably what he meant regarding challenging me when he wrote that about me years ago, which is very complimentary, I must say.
Yeah. You have to mention that to him next time you speak to him.
Yeah. So yeah, I've enjoyed working with Pete, and it's apparently ongoing at the moment because he's in between schedules with the Who.
Excellent. Excellent.
So I think I'm about 6-7 songs in on the musical.
Oh, that's
but
fantastic.
Using other drummers. I think he'll be using Simon Phillips. I think. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you keep crossing paths with Simon Phillips here and there, or not crossing paths as it would be.
Well, in the early days, I mean, Simon was one of my heroes. You know, when he was in Judy Zook, I loved his playing and the Mike Oldfield stuff, and he got involved in The Who as well. He was a fabulous drummer in The Who. I mean, I went to see him in Los Angeles actually play when they had the full brass section, and obviously him playing with Buffalo Skinners. And me working with Pete at that psychedelic album, we crossed paths by playing in the other band.
It's a bit funny. It's very funny.
A bit of a twist there, but I was involved with Zildjian Cymbals. I still am, and Simon is a Zildjian in Dorsey, and more so in the '80s that we crossed paths physically, where we would be asked to do some drum clinics together. I did more clinics in the '80s, and you know it was a real blast playing with Simon, because he's a fabulous musician, as everyone knows, and he's a great clinician. He really is a great clinician when he plays the drums, and it was just an honor to, you know, to be on the same bill as him, but also to, because he was one of my heroes, to sit and play duets with him, which is what we would do on these clinics. At the end, we would play together. We would finish the show playing together. So we would do a little rehearsal ourselves. You know, we would hire a rehearsal room in London, and we would have two or three hours together. And this happened several times. So we got to know each other really well. And actually embracing each other's style. You know, we'd ask me to play a bit and we'd join in, and I'd ask him to play something. And we really would exchange ideas in a rehearsal room, which was phenomenal. So I love his style as well. You know, I adore his playing, and I think I know Pete loves his playing as well. So I have an affinity with Simon's playing, and I think Pete realizes that. And we can play in a certain way with a certain style of music, and Pete uses us for that reason, I think. Although we bring our own individuality to that, which is different, but somewhere we can join together. We can be separate on each side, but somewhere we can speak the same language, me and Simon.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let me bring up the Buffalo Skinners real quick, since you brought that up. I think it's always been of interest to big country fans, you know, maybe what you thought of the one album that really did not feature your drumming on it. And obviously everyone knew that you and Simon were you know, fellow admirers of each other, but I'm just curious what you thought of his approach was to a big country album, and if that seemed strange to you at the time to listen to that music with someone else playing on it.
Do you know, I got to say, because it was Simon, I loved it. I was thrilled to hear his drumming, because I love his playing so much. So that I was biased. Had it been somebody else, I would have felt a bit odd. I probably wouldn't have even wanted to hear it, to be honest.
Right.
But being Simon, and I know what he brings to it, I thought he did a fabulous job. I loved his sound. I did think that he'd gone in and listened to it. He'd done his homework, because I thought there was certain doffing your cap to how I would perhaps approach it. No, I thought his approach was bang on for the time. I thought the choice of drummer was perfect, because it's a tricky area, this, for me, because I have I have started to tell the story. It's a very tricky area, this, because, you know...
Well, I read your interview in Classic Rock where you talked about
the period I was outside the band was an unhappy time for me, because it was something I didn't want to see happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a really weird period, that, for me, because I went in and did, and I don't know which album it was. It was either Why the Long Face or
I mean, No Place Like Home,
no
I think.
No Place Like Home. There was one where I purely was not in the band, and they still wanted me to play.
Yeah, that was the one.
They're my mates, they were my family, and I went in and they did the album, you know, as a paid session musician, which I found really odd. I felt very uncomfortable, but as soon as I was with them, you know, it was as if nothing had changed. Musically, everything fell into place. As much as those two albums don't get really revered songwriting-wise, I'm actually really pleased with my drums on those albums. You know, it's not particularly the songs or the direction. I was very confused at the time, I thought. It was a very, you know, it was a bit like between, I can only liken it to between seasons changing, you know, between like before you go from summer to autumn, you know, there's that period of it being a bit muddled where the weather doesn't know quite what it's doing. It's not quite doing summer, it's not quite doing autumn. And I think Big Country went through that phase of not really knowing what it was doing, but it was still very creative, you know. Some of those songs... So one or two of them are really great. I still think, because I'm involved in them, I hear them differently to anyone else. I'm too close to them. But I was really pleased with my drum sound in some of those tracks, and some of those songs that I've got some of my best drumming in, I think, but they really don't get the airing because people go, oh, I don't like those two albums. That was that funny period, you know. But, you know, as I've spoken before in interviews, it was something, if you don't mind me waffling, I'm still waffling here.
No, feel free. This is all great for us.
Again, Big Country went through, as much as I said at the beginning, you know, Big Country is seen as that rousing, strong, you know, driving, marching off the war band, you know. It was very delicate underneath, Big Country was, as what played out with Stuart no longer being here. It was a very delicate band. And again, Fragile Thing is, yeah, it's such a great song. To me, he's almost singing about the band as well as relationships, because that's what a band is relationships. It's very fragile. And what had been happening during that time, I remember it was July 1980, I think it was 89, I think it was. I remember it's in my passport, which is really strange, in my passport, because we're in Jersey. It was the last show of our tour. And Stuart had already been disillusioned with certain things privately in the management side of things, where he felt that things weren't moving forward. There was a lot of frustration from Stuart feeling that we should be a bigger band than we were after, you know, the first three seminal albums. And I know he was very much looking at putting, for a long time he was privately saying to me, I don't know if he was even saying it to Bruce or Tony, but he was saying to me that, as he said it in his own Scottish way, the ball's gone over the fence and I don't think I'm going to be able to get it back, is what he said. And he meant that about the band, about not that we weren't capable, but that it was like we were only as strong as the sum of the parts, and it wasn't the band that had creating the problems. It was the perception from the record company. It was an uphill struggle that he couldn't see a way to make things any better.
Right.
And I know that was troubling him for a good couple of years leading up to that. I remember it being, I don't know, 19th of July, we were in Jersey, something like that. But we I think we'd done this whole tour. It was, you know, we were now traveling by train across Europe. You know, there's a whole different mindset to touring. Things were changing in the music business as well. And Stuart was very disillusioned with things, and he used to confide in me a lot. Again, it's personal for the fact that what he said to me at that time, I didn't know if he'd be speaking to the other guys, but he would often talk to me about how he felt Big Country perhaps at that time had done all had really achieved all he felt it could achieve.
Right.
He felt there was a lot more to achieve, but it wasn't through the lack of the band's power. It was the lack of the machinery to get them there, you know. And with that, he said to me that he felt he should quit the band and that we should carry on without him. Wow. Even at that time. And of course, so I wouldn't entertain that, and privately I said, don't be ridiculous, you know, you're probably feeling a bit down, and you know, things are going to be fine, and you know, we need to kick in and more fuss about this, that and that and this. But I didn't realize it was really, really playing on his mind as much as it was, because he was a very private person, as well as he would, you know, let things overflow, but they would be very, very choice things he would let you know. But you know, you're all wise in hindsight. And he spoke to me in my room and said to me that he was going to be quitting the band, or he felt the band should be put to bed. And it was something I thought would be a tragedy, because I thought Stuart was, you know, not only feeling perhaps pressure from being away from his family for so long and having the other issues that were plaguing him during perhaps the whole of Big Country's career, was he had lots of you know, he was always torn between wanting to get out there and conquer the world and at the same time be at home and be a family man. There was always a duality he fought with. And that was quite a seminal time for me, because we had a meeting within the band separately. In fact, Stuart wrote me a note and put it under my door and talked about pretty much saying, you know, we're going to break, I'm going to split the band up, and come the last gig in Jersey, where it's going to be the last show ever, and he's going to let Ian know, and the record company know, and John Giddings know, and all the agents and all those people, the big players that we had at that time, he was going to make it clear that he was going to put the band to bed.
Wow.
And he wrote me a personal note, which I still have, about good luck with anything you do, and you know, I'm sorry it's had to come to this, but I can't see any way out of it, and I feel Big Country have achieved all they can achieve, although I feel it should have been more, and there are still more to give, but it's really like we've got this great engine, and we've got this great engine, and there's no wheels on it, you know.
Wow.
And so
this was 1989.
Yes, it was 89.
Okay.
Was it 89?
Okay, yeah. Can I chime in on this one?
And also, was it 91, John? You tell
it
me.
It was first of July, 1989, Fort Regent in Jersey.
That's it. Was that Jersey? Yeah.
Jersey, Fort Regent.
Yeah, that's right. So we knew about a week and a half ahead of that show when we had a band meeting together with Ian that Stuart decided that he'd had enough and the band was finished.
Wow.
So I personally spoke to Stuart privately on many occasions on that trip because we traveled a lot together and I sat next to Stuart. And I basically begged him not to split the band up because I felt, you know, if we survived all the highs, we've got to try and survive the lows because, you know, it's building on what the things are rather than look at the band, you know. And I could see that his head wasn't in a great place at that time. And, you know, it came to that awful day where we had a band meeting after the show. I think it was perhaps before we played, and everyone had flown in, the management had flown in, the agents had flown in, promoters had flown in, and it was officially, you know, said by Stuart in the room that this was it. And, you know, there was tears, and, you know, it was a very emotional time where, you know, disbelief was you know, yeah. I kind of knew it would happen because when Stuart says he's going to do something, he does it. You know, he was a man of his word. And I saw it perhaps that he needed some time out more than anything, and the things may just get better.
Right.
He assured me that it would be permanent, and then this letter that he'd written to me telling me, he said he'd written to everyone to say, you know, really hope I do well in any new venture that I take. He wants me to take gigs as soon as I can, blah, blah, blah. So that was it. You know, it was a very emotional time. There was a pathetic celebration of all the years we'd had together with Shaman. Pain and tears as well from different people in the room. It was very emotionally charged, and we all went our separate ways. And I made it clear in the room. I said, look, at that time, you know, it was different for me at that time. I had a few things that I constantly had things that I was not doing. I was doing a lot of albums, but I wasn't doing any touring because I wouldn't take the touring. My band was big country with my family. But I had at that time Tears for Fears world tour to do. I had the tour to do with Sting on Soul Cages. I had Fish asking me to do some touring. I had a few things, and I ended up doing a little bit of each with those. But I said to the band, look, if you're going to break the band up, I'm going to start taking this work. And it means if I take it, I'm going to have to do it. You know, I can't go out on a tour with Sting and then, you know, 3 weeks later they change their mind. I can't do that. I've got to know that what they're telling me is going to be happening because, you know, it's my reputation at stake here, and I've got to survive this breakup. Stuart assured me that it was permanent and that there wouldn't be any change, and, you know, so I went off and did what I did. I went off and worked with Sting. I was going to do a tour on the Soul Cages tour when Vinnie Colaiuta was going to be touring with Joni Mitchell out in. I was going to start in Mexico with them. I went in and did 2 weeks rehearsal with Sting, and then Joni Mitchell's tour got cancelled, and Vinnie came back onto the tour as I was only depping, but I was able to do a TV show and some live recording. We did a re-record of one of the songs. I think it was called All This Time. We re-recorded it to do a live TV show for the Union Rules. Had to re-record. So I went in the studio and recorded that with Sting as well. Plus, I went out and did some touring with Tears of Fears on Sowing the Seeds of Love, some live stuff out in Europe, and a tour with Fish. And then I went back to my roots. I just went back with Simon Townsend, and we went out to America to try and get a record deal with a band called Huge Big Thing.
Yeah, wow.
And we did an album, actually, because I'd done some early stuff with Go West with a producer called Gary Stevenson. And Gary was still using me for studio work in the Isle of Man. So I went to Gary and said, you know, he always loved my playing and loved Simon's music. So Gary produced an album. We went out, we did some shows in America, and we ended up getting a deal on... Armit Oettingen's label. What was that?
Atlantic
Records. Yeah.
Okay. Good pause. Yeah. Fine. I had no idea.
Thank you, sir. We had one album deal to do at that time when the band had broken up to do an album. So I was busy, not only doing all my session work, trying to spin plates and make my diary work, and I'd heard nothing from the band. Nobody was talking to each other. And I'd gone to America. we got a record deal. I met Ahmet Ertegun. We signed to him to do my album. I was now in the studio in the Isle of Man. Then I get a call from Procol Harum. Gary Brooker rings me up from Procol Harum and says, you know, Robin Trower and the original band members, Matthew Fisher himself, have reformed with Keith Reed to do a new Procol Harum album since BJ Wilson died. And it's going to be the first album when I come and do that album. So I ended up kind of joining Procol Harum during the first album, you know. I was with him for 17 years, actually.
Wow. And, I had no idea.
Yeah, so whilst I was doing all my many things, and particularly the fact that I was contracted to, I'd signed a record deal with Atlantic to do this album and to do a tour. And I think it was a year later, I think Tony rang me, and was it a year later? I haven't got a time frame here now, I must admit. It's all a bit grey. I know, so much work.
I know No Place Like Home came out in 91.
Yeah, I had a call to Tony rang me. No, Ian rang me and said he rang me after not speaking to me for 6 or 7 months. I can't remember what it was. As if nothing had happened, and said, Mark, it's Ian. Where are you? I said, where am I? I'm in the Isle of Man. What do you mean, where am I? Oh, the band have made a mistake. Stuart's back in action. We got some worn down records, but I've got what? And I couldn't do it. I couldn't come back. I was contracted to do my other stuff. I was also really annoyed the fact that after all that I pleaded with, you know, to not break up, that all of a sudden that they were doing a U-turn. I was pleased at the same time. And as it happened, I went in and did the. Was it No Place Like Home? You'd have to remind me because my brain's not good on albums.
Yeah,
it was. I went in and did it. Yeah. So it was very, very strange because I was in between working with, you know, Gary Stevenson and Procol Harum's new album at that time. I was still recording in between recording. So I was recording with my own band that was now suddenly back together again. And they went and used Pat Ahern, I think it was, who was originally with Simon Townsend before me.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I suggested to Dan, because, you know, he had he used a lot of drums, and he was the early prog drummer that I took over from. And as he knew Tony, I thought he would be a good choice just to, you know, in a way, I was hoping he would keep my seat warm, in a way of saying, you know, I'd always promised I'd come back.
Well, Bruce said Pat got the job because he decorated Tony's house.
He did, yeah. that's probably part of it as well. But, again, it's all a bit hazy with the time frame here, but I remember one Christmas, because I stayed in contact with Tony, in fact, Tony could stay in contact with me as well. Tony had, again, my time frame's a bit vague, but Tony, as after doing that, the album No Place Like Home, Wide Long Face, Tony rang up and said, he really missed me, would love me to be involved in the band. They've done a fabulous new album. But obviously they haven't now got a drummer. The drummers that they used, I think it was Pat Ahern and Chris Bell, didn't work out, blah, blah, blah. And they ultimately still like me back. And I said, no problem, I'd love to come back. Things hadn't quite worked out with Huge Big Thing. I'd done the album and there was terrible politics flying around in the record label regarding any backing for, you know, putting that album out. And things were, you know, I could either stay as a session drummer with Procol Harum and blah, blah, blah. And he decided I want to get back into my family. That was my family. I'd have really missed it. Mm.
We missed you too.
The fact that Tony had asked me, you know, and I'd never wanted to be, I never left the band. That was the whole point. I never left the band. The band broke up. Nobody knew that. And when I came back into the band, which I was delighted to do, especially after hearing the album, and, you know, when I heard Simon was on it, I was thrilled at his drumming, and I thought, I can get right stuck into that. And I really enjoyed the rehearsals, learning those songs, and making that the predominant tour, playing those songs. He was right in the pocket where I liked to play as well. You know, he was very sympathetic to my style. So I really enjoyed coming back into the band on the Buffalo Skinners. It was fabulous that Simon had done that. I was so pleased it was him. And I was thrilled to be back. The only thing that really did frustrate me was when I came back into the band, you know, all of a sudden it was news that Mark was back. They had to come up with a story. So they said to me, whatever happens, you've got to say you quit. And I said, well, I didn't quit. We had that, you know, the band broke up. It was like, you know, we can't say that. You're not allowed to say that because we never said anything. We just said you've left. And it was like, well, charming. Thanks very much.
Oh, my.
So it was like, well, it's going to make me sound like I left the band. That's awful. I never left the band. In fact, the only person who's ever left Big Country is Tony, and he's left twice.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that. Well, Tony, actually, recently, Tony obviously,
left,
but...
Yeah, Tony left, again, in, I can't remember the time, you know, 10 years ago, Tony quit the band, I think.
Oh, yeah, he left right after the Drown to Damascus tour in Europe, I think.
Yeah, Tony quit the band, yeah. And, you know, he quit the band again, you know, in recent times. But if you look at Wikipedia, I think it's like, I left the band to join the shadow past. Landscape of the session world, the shadowy pastures of the session world, you know. I didn't at all. I was always doing session work. So when I came back into the band, I remember feeling really awkward. I was being interviewed, you know, because it was like, oh, for the first time, I wasn't always interviewed because it was always Stuart and the guitars, and I tended to be the quiet one in the band. But all of a sudden, it was on me because I was the new focus of the band, the man that had quit, you know. So the interviews were, why did you quit the band? And I remember one interview we were doing on television with Ian Grant looking at me with daggers saying, you dare say what was the truth, you stick to the story.
You know? Oh, so, have to find that clip.
I'm looking around the room thinking, what do I say? How do I say it? Oh, so I sort of say, oh, well, yeah, I don't even know what I said. I said, I'm really glad to be back with my family. And, you know,
that's a good way to say it. I'm surprised they would make you go through with that charade.
I found it so difficult because I wanted just to say, but then at the same time, you know, we're not the Beatles. It's not a big story. And, you know, as long as we're together now, it doesn't really matter. It was more personal that I wanted to say that, because those fans that loved the band, I didn't want just to think, you know, at that time it was me that deserted them or something, you know, because I'm intensely loyal. Hence my still in the band now, you know. Hence my talking to the band and begging Stuart not to split the band up at the time. You know, I spent a good 2 weeks really trying to get him to keep the band together. Wow. There we are. I didn't realize I'd talk so long about that episode, but it was a sad episode for me. But perhaps it was something that was inevitable, because it was Stuart could not cope with the band. What wasn't happening with the band, you know, he felt the band, as I'm going back now, should have been a lot bigger than it was. And I think that's perhaps the flavor of the band. When I look at it now, from where we are now, you know, we have a rich, rich, rich history of fabulous music, amazing things I've done in my life. But still, when I see things written about us and it says they should have been a bigger band, you know, we should have. I accept that.
And we are going to have to end it right there. That's all we have time for episode 32. But wow, great stuff. Hope you guys enjoyed listening to that as much as we enjoyed listening to that as it was happening. Just great conversations with Mark. And the good news is that's only part one. And part two is just as interesting, if not more so. So that will be coming in episode 33. So really big thanks to Nirja for putting this together for us. We really appreciate it. And of course to Mark for not only spending so much time with us, but for being so open and just so willing to divulge so much cool information about Big Country that we've, you know, always wanted to know. And now we do. So thank you very much, Mark and Nirja. And thanks to John Gouveia, as always. And on behalf of Svine, this is Tom saying thank you for listening. And we will see you back here next time with episode 33, part two of our discussion with Mark. And as always, you can email us at bigcountrypodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate your emails, and we really enjoy reading your feedback. So if you're listening to the show and thinking that you like it, consider letting us know. It goes a long way in keeping us inspired to keep doing these. So we do appreciate it. You can also find us on Facebook at The Great Divide Podcast. Just search for The Great Divide Podcast on Facebook, and you'll find us there. A lot of great discussion happens on that page. And so that's it. We will see you guys next time very soon with part two of the Mark Brzezicki in-depth interview. Thanks a lot. Take care.